Well, we have got a pretty long class today. If you take a look at your handout, you'll see 6 pages of notes plus a couple of extra pages. And that's quite a bit of stuff, and there's quite a bit of readings in there. In our classes, we probably won't do much of the reading just because of the amount of time it would take. Most of this reading is reading that you were asked to do in your homework. And if you haven't done it, then I suggest that maybe you do, just because there's some very interesting stories. And this is kind of the pinnacle time that Israel looks back as the pinnacle of their history, the best time of their history. And that's what we're going to talk about today. We're going to cram it all into one class. What we're going to cram into one class is all the stories dealing with Israel's United Kingdom. You see, that's our title, the United Kingdom. And there were 3 kings that Israel had during that time. The first was Saul, the second was David, and the third was Solomon. Okay? In coming weeks, we'll see why there was only 3 and what happened after Solomon. But for today, we're going to talk about the 3 kings of Israel, the United Kingdom of Israel. Before we do, though, let's remind ourselves why they became a kingdom, why they felt that they needed a king. And a lot of that was fed by what we talked about in our last class. No, not last week. Last week we did a review. But our last class was the Philistine menace. And let's remind ourselves a little bit about that. Okay, the Philistines, if you recall, these were the people to the west of Israel on the Mediterranean Sea. If you remember back to our pictures, this is the red tinges on the seacoast. That referred to the Philistines. They were a very advanced civilization, a very strong economy, very well-organized military, a different level of power than what Israel had dealt with before they had to start dealing with the Philistines. Okay? They'd been around a while, called the Sea Peoples, understood to have come from Crete, i.e. Greece area, and there's a lot of history there that we learn from non-biblical sources. We see some interactions with Egypt, but that the Philistines were such a strong power, they felt they could attack and defeat Egypt. Well, they lost, but that's the level of power that they were. So, how far back do they go? Well, let's look way back in Genesis with the patriarchs, with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Do we see the Philistines there then? The answer is yes. We see Abraham and Isaac both interacting with Philistines. Why didn't the Exodus go through Philistia? When the Israelites left Egypt, the normal path was on the way of the Philistines. That was the name of the main road that went up through Canaan. But they didn't go that way because they weren't ready. They weren't ready for the battles that would ensue. Partly because every few miles along that way of the Philistines road, they would encounter an Egyptian outpost and would have to fight that. But here we see in Exodus, we saw the reference to that road being called the way of the Philistines. How much of Philistia remained untaken after Joshua, after the conquest? All of it. They didn't touch it. They hadn't taken any of the Philistine territory. And that came to bite them later because they were called to take all the territory, including the land of Philistia. But they didn't. And as a result, the Philistines became a problem that they had to contend with later. We saw 2 judges there at the beginning of the book of Judges. We saw Shamgar, our first minor judge, and we have 1 verse about him, but he dealt with Philistines. And then our last judge in the book of Judges was Samson. And that was his focus, was the Philistines. Then in first book of Samuel, that's kind of where we picked up our story last study. And we saw that early on, the Israelites lost at Ebenezer. Okay, they lost against the Philistines. Why? Because they decided to fight the Philistines without inquiring of God, without asking God, without looking to God for his guidance and his involvement and his protection. They thought they had lost because God wasn't with them. God wasn't fighting for them, and that was true, but they thought it was because they had forgotten to bring God along. So they sent and brought the ark. They sent for the Ark of the Covenant, had it brought, and to them that was bringing God into the equation. The Philistines saw that, and they felt the same way, and they were scared to death because now they were going to have to fight a god, and they were afraid of fighting a god. So they had this battle, and what happened? The Philistines had a victory. Not just any victory, but a huge victory. A victory that just routed. Thousands and thousands of Israelites died. The high priest's sons of Israel died in the battle. And the Ark of the Covenant was taken. They lost the Ark of the Covenant. That had a huge impact on Israel. They were in hopeless despair because they believed that they had lost God. They had lost God. Not only that, God was now on the other side, so there was no hope at all for them. Well, we see that the Philistines took the ark, but they didn't keep it, because wherever they took it, it created problems. Their great god Dagon fell down and bowed down to the Ark of the Covenant, okay, showing the power of God, power of Yahweh, over Dagon. People in Ashdod and Gaza, where the ark was taken, grew tumors, and there were rats rampant, and people were dying. And so the Philistines sent the ark back. They sent it on a cart with some cows that had just had calves, and sure enough, those cows left rather than being concerned about their calves, and went. They took the ark to Israel. As the Israelites that were out in the field saw this ark coming, they were thrilled. They were ecstatic. They shouted praises to God. They cut up the wood of the cart and made a fire and on a big rock and sacrificed the cows and gave a sacrifice of praise to God for bringing the Ark of the Covenant back. As a result of this, Israel recognized their problem. And we saw the same cycle here as we've seen throughout the book of Judges, that ABC cycle, the apostasy, battered, cried out, deliverer, emancipate, and forget. We saw that cycle here. And they had turned away from God. God allowed them to be battered by the Philistines. And now they return, they repent, they cry out to God. God raised up a judge, a deliverer named Samuel. And Samuel called them back to God and called them to be faithful. And we see that that's what they did. Is they did go and commit themselves to God, covenanted themselves, fasted, confessed their sins. And then when the Philistines saw that the Israelites were gathered there at Mizpah, they came and attacked. And through that, God gave Israel a victory. So they were emancipated. Okay? And so we have that whole cycle of the judges there with Samuel. And Samuel was, we'll see today, the last judge of Israel. So Israel was blessed after this victory. They had the victory. Some of the towns that the Philistines had taken from Israel were returned to Israel, and there was a time of peace, a good time of peace. But all along, through this exercise or through these experiences, Israel thought, you know, our problem is we don't have a central leader. Now, Samuel was more of a central leader than any of the other judges had been before. If you remember, all the other judges were all localized guys dealing with localized problems. But now the Philistines were a national threat, not just a threat to a local area around Philistia. They were a threat to all of Israel, and God raised up the judge Samuel to lead all of Israel. And we've seen that Samuel then went around on a circuit and judged all of Israel during his time. But the Israelites got to looking and said, you know, Samuel, you're getting old, and your sons really are not the caliber of people that you are. We need a king. We need someone to lead us. Why? Most importantly, because all our neighbors have kings, and we want a king just like them. So a king that's going to march us out into battle and protect us and defend us and all that. Samuel didn't like that. Samuel didn't approve of them having a king because they already had a king. And that was true. They had a king named Yahweh, the king God, the king of all kings. And he was a great king. The problem wasn't that this king wasn't physical. The problem was they didn't follow this king. And that's where they kept getting into trouble. But they thought their problem was they didn't have a physical king. Did God oppose anointing a king? No. In fact, he said, give him a king. But it's going to be a king, I'm going to tell you. Okay, God chooses the king. God raises up his leaders. The king must be chosen by God and must remain faithful to God. So we also talked a little bit about, is God against government? No, God raises up governments. God establishes all governments. Paul and Peter alike talk about how governments exist at God's granting. And we are to obey our leaders and to obey our governments and follow our leaders as our leaders serve God, but then also follow our leaders even if they don't serve God and obey them. Now, in summary of all that, we can look at our picture concepts for the Philistine menace. And the first thing we see is the massive army posed in the background. And that reminds us that Israel was now threatened by a major power that wasn't just a localized power that threatened a little local area, but rather a big power, mighty forces that threatened the whole nation. We see the warriors with iron weapons, and that reminds us that Philistia had a well-established, well-organized military, very different than the other enemies that Israel had encountered before. You then see the gloating king and the arrogant warrior, and that reminds us of the great victory that the Philistines had over the Israelites, so that the Israelites lost to the Philistines their most prized possession, the Ark of the Covenant that represented God's presence. You see the figure with the tears in his eyes down at the bottom, and that points out that the loss of the Ark created a feeling among all of Israel of hopeless despair. They had lost God. God was not with them any longer. There was no hope for them. The other figure clasping the cloak of the weeping man points out that through these experiences, some of the Israelites saw what they thought was the problem was that they needed a central government, a central king, a central leader. Their answer was in government. In the vision of the throne with the king in the back, the Philistine experience led to the concept of a king over Israel. And that's where we'll pick it up today. Okay? And again, we're going to talk about three kings that Israel had. And we'll take them one at a time. We'll just kind of walk through there. We've got a different page for each one. In class, we have reading slips. There's so many readings, and most of them we're not going to read in class. But the reading slips just tell you the page, page 2, page 3, page 4. So if you're following along at home here, I recommend that you do go through the readings. And in fact, plan to take a little extra time. Don't just read the specific verses. The specific verses we have here are just kind of summary verses of each question. But there's so much behind and so many great verses and great parts of the story that we're skipping just on account of time to give you the key highlights here. Okay? So, for instance, read chapter 9. I mean, great story. And really even chapter 8 feeds into that about Israel asking as a king. But the whole story in chapter 9 is a great story in itself of how God brings Saul to Samuel. So, and that's our first question. How did Samuel know who God wanted to be the first king of Israel? Starting at verse 15. Now the day before Saul came, the Lord had revealed this to Samuel. About this time tomorrow, I will send you a man from the land of Benjamin. Anoint him leader over my people Israel. He will deliver my people from the hand of the Philistines. I have looked upon my people, for their cry has reached me. So how did Samuel know? God showed him. God told him. God brought Saul to Samuel. Samuel didn't have to do anything other than just follow God's direction. He said, I'm going to bring him to you. When he comes, I'll tell you this is him, and you anoint him, okay, as the first king. So how did he become king? Chapter 10, verse 1, Samuel took a flask of oil and poured it on Saul's head and kissed him, saying, has not Yahweh anointed you leader over his inheritance? So Samuel anointed the judge Samuel, the prophet Samuel, anointed Saul as the first king, and in doing so said, aren't you the one that God has chosen, that God has called to be the first king of Israel? Okay. Now, later on in that chapter then, we see that Samuel, because at this time it's just Samuel and Saul. Okay. Samuel's not anointing Saul before a whole crowd, but rather it's just them. And then later on in the chapter, Samuel introduces Saul to the rest of Israel. And what he does, what's interesting, is he calls all of Israel before him. Okay, he summons in verse 17 the people of Israel at Mizpah, kind of where they had been before, where they had dedicated themselves to God before with the Philistine battles. And you see that in verse 20, Samuel brought out all the tribes of Israel and then called among those tribes, and the tribe of Benjamin was chosen. And then he brought forward the tribe of Benjamin and clan by clan, and he picked Matri's clan. And so what he did is he went tribe by tribe, clan by clan, family by family, until he ended up with Saul. Okay. Why did he do that? Verse 24, Samuel said to all the people, "Do you see the man that Yahweh has chosen? There's no one like him among all the people." Then the people shouted, "Long live the king." So here the first king, Saul, Samuel kind of did this by lot, knowing that this was God's chosen, so God was going to lead it to Saul, and he did. And so that showed all of Israel that Saul was not Samuel's choice, but rather Yahweh's choice, God's choice. And who had he chosen? Saul looked like a king. He was taller, a head taller than everyone else, it says, and strong and mighty, and just looked like a someone to follow. Okay, looked like a king. And you see that they accepted him here. Soon after Saul was made king, we have a crisis in chapter 11 for the town of Jabesh-Gilead, which is over on the eastern side of the Jordan River. Okay, Saul was from Benjamin. Benjamin is on the western side of the Jordan River. It's one of the western tribes. It's the tribe right north of Judah. And so now we've got a remote tribe on the eastern side, and this is up further north too, part of the Manasseh. And Jabesh-Gilead gets attacked. This remote eastern town gets attacked by the Ammonites, okay, the neighbors to the east. And, okay, Saul, are you concerned about your local area, or are you concerned about the nation? And what happens here? Verse 5. Just then, Saul was returning from the fields behind his oxen. Okay, you see, after he had been anointed king, what was he doing? He went back home to farming. Okay, what kind of a king is that? Okay, behind his oxen, and he asked, "What's wrong with the people? Why are they weeping?" And then they repeated to him what the men of Jabesh had said about how they were attacked and besieged by the men of Ammon. Then Saul, when Saul heard their words, the Spirit of God came on him, and in power he burned with anger. He took a pair of oxen, cut them into pieces, and sent the pieces by messengers throughout Israel, proclaiming, "This is what will be done to the oxen of anyone who does not follow Saul and Samuel." Then the terror of the Lord fell on the people, and they turned out as one man. When Saul mustered them at Bezek, the men of Israel numbered 300,000, and the men of Judah 30,000. So 330,000 men showed up to go fight the Ammonites. And then verse 11, the next day Saul separated his men into three divisions. During the last watch of the night, they broke into the camp of the Ammonites and slaughtered them until the heat of the day. Those who survived were scattered so that no two of them were left together. So a huge victory, a huge show of Saul acting as a king. He responded to a threat of someone in his nation, a national threat, and he mustered and he called the nation together, and the nation worked together under this new king to go and take care of this problem. So here we see he becomes king, but he starts acting like a farmer, but then he acts like a king when he's called upon. Okay? Why was this story so important? Verses 14 and 15. Then Samuel said to the people, "Come, let's go to Gilgal and there reaffirm the kingship." So all the people went to Gilgal and confirmed Saul as king in the presence of Yahweh. There they sacrificed fellowship offerings before Yahweh, and Saul and all the Israelites held a great celebration. So this kicked off Saul's leadership as king, and it brought all of Israel together. Everyone rallied behind Saul. Everyone accepted Saul as their king, and they committed themselves to following this king that God has given them. So they confirmed the kingship of Saul. So very important to, because this is a new chapter in their history. They've been a confederacy before. Each tribe doing their own thing. Each person doing their own thing. Remember that last verse of the book of Judges? In those days there was no king. Everyone did as he saw fit. Well now, everyone, every individual, every tribe, every clan agrees to come beneath the central king of Saul. And so this experience here for the city of Jabesh-Gilead really helped unify the nation together under Saul. So what did Samuel then do after Saul's confirmation? Next chapter, verse 2. Samuel says to all of Israel, "Now you have a king as your leader. As for me, I'm old and gray, and my sons are here with you. I've been your leader from my youth until this day." So it's been quite a few years. Then verse 13. "Now here's the king that you've chosen, the one that you've asked for. See, Yahweh has set a king over you. Now if you fear Yahweh and serve and obey him and do not rebel against his commands, and if both you and the king who reigns over you follow Yahweh your God, good. But if you don't obey Yahweh and if you rebel against his commands, his hand will be against you as it was against your fathers." And we've skipped a lot of verses, but what Samuel does here is he transfers the leadership. People look to Samuel as being the leader of the nation. So he transfers the leadership from himself then to Saul. Here's your king. Follow him. Don't follow me. But more importantly, follow God. As you and your king follow Yahweh, all will be great. God will bless you. But if you turn from Yahweh, if your king turns from Yahweh, and you don't obey and follow his commands, then he's going to reject you and punish you just as he has done to your forefathers. Okay? So there's a quick picture of the story of Saul. Now, what were his good qualities? Okay, let's look at his highlights and lowlights. His good qualities, starting at verse 9, as Saul turned to leave Samuel, God changed Saul's heart, and all these signs were fulfilled that day when they arrived at Gibeah, which is where Saul was from. And in fact, that's where Saul lived, even as king, in the town of Gibeah. A procession of prophets met him. The Spirit of God came upon him in power, and he joined in their prophesying. So here we see he had a passion for God. He really was sought after God, at least in the early years here. And then chapter 14, starting at verse 47. After Saul had assumed rule over Israel, he fought against their enemies on every side. Moab, the Ammonites, Edom, the kings of Zobah, and the Philistines. Wherever he turned, he inflicted punishment on them. He fought valiantly and defeated the Amalekites, delivering Israel from the hands of those who had plundered them. So he was a good and successful soldier. He brought peace, to a degree, to Israel. Okay, Philistines were still creating a lot of problems, and there were other problems there. But he did bring a lot of victories to Israel and united Israel together in national defense. So he accomplished those things as a king. Now, one of the stories that we have in one of his battles, because he was a warrior, there were a lot of, you see these fights on every side, it says, enemies on every side, Moab, Ammon, Edom, Zobah, Philistines, etc., Amalekites. During one of those battles, we have the story of Jonathan, his son, tasting honey. What poor trait about Saul was revealed in that story? Let's read a few scattered verses. Verse 24. Now the men were in distress that day because Saul had bound the people under an oath, saying, "Cursed be any man who eats food before evening comes, before I have avenged myself on my enemies." So none of the troops tasted food. And then verse 27. But Jonathan had not heard that his father had bound the people with this oath. So he reached out the end of a staff that was in his hand and dipped it into a honeycomb. He raised his hand to his mouth and his eyes brightened. Okay, so he ate some honey out of a honeycomb as he was walking by, not knowing what his father had said. And then 38. Saul therefore said, "Come here, all you who are leaders of the army, and let's find out what sin has been committed today. As surely as Yahweh who rescues Israel lives, even if it lies with my son Jonathan, he must die." But not one of the men said a word. Okay, and then they go through this lot choosing to figure out who was the problem, and then it falls on Jonathan. In verse 43, then Saul said to Jonathan, "Tell me what you've done." So Jonathan told him, "I merely tasted a little honey with the end of my staff, and now must I die?" Saul said, "May God deal with me, be it ever so severely, if you do not die, Jonathan." But the men said to Saul, "Should Jonathan die? He who has brought about this great deliverance in Israel? Never. As surely as the Lord lives, not a hair of his head will fall to the ground, for he did this today with God's help," the victory that they had just had. So the men rescued Jonathan, and he was not put to death. So what do you see with Saul here? very impulsive. He makes this impulsive command, nobody can eat anything until we're done fighting. You know, well, that's not very good. I mean, they could fight and eat while they're fighting and keep their strength to be able to fight better, right? But he made that. And then you see he continues to make rash curses and oaths, even telling Jonathan, you're dead. May God punish me, be it ever so severely, if I don't kill you for this. And he doesn't kill him for it, right? So very impulsive, very rash, and that creates a lot of problems for Saul throughout his kingship. Well, how spiritually discerning was Saul? I mean, that's really going to be the mark of a good king of Israel, right? Is their relationship with God. Well, let's look at some examples. Chapter 13, starting at verse 8. This is at the very beginning of his kingship. Okay? Saul waited 7 days, the time set by Samuel, but Samuel did not come to Gilgal, and Saul's men began to scatter. So Saul said, bring me the burnt offerings and the fellowship offerings, and Saul offered up the burnt offering. Just as he finished making the offering, Samuel arrived, and Saul went out to greet him. Samuel had told Saul, go to Gilgal and wait there for me for 7 days, and I will come, and I'll make sacrifices to God, and then you'll be able to do what you need to do. And they were being attacked by the Philistines, and he was scared. His people were scared. They were running away. His army was going away, and he broke down and completed the sacrifice rather than waiting for Samuel as he had been commanded. And as a result, verse 13, you have acted foolishly, Samuel said. You have not kept the command the Lord your God gave you. If you had, he would have established your kingdom over Israel for all time. But now your kingdom will not endure. Yahweh has sought out a man after his own heart and appointed him leader of his people because you have not kept Yahweh's command. So as a result of him not obeying God's simple command of waiting 7 days for Samuel to come and give this offering, and he did the offering himself, that's showing a lack of trust, a lack of obedience, a lack of following God. And as a result, he would no longer continue to, his dynasty would not continue. God has now rejected him as king, even though his kingship has really just started. And God has sought out someone who's more so after his own heart. Chapter 15, starting at verse 2. This is what Yahweh Almighty says, I will punish the Amalekites for what they did to Israel when they waylaid them as they came up from Egypt. Okay, if you remember when Israel first came out of Egypt, they got attacked by Amalekites. This is the story when Moses held up his hands and they won, and when he dropped his hands, they were losing and all that. Okay, and then, now, go, Saul, attack the Amalekites and totally destroy everything that belongs to them. Do not spare them. Put to death men and women, children and infants, cattle and sheep, camels and donkeys. Totally wipe them out. Okay? This is their punishment for what they did to Israel many years ago when Israel was coming out of Egypt. So, what did Saul do? Verse 9. Saul and the army spared Agag, okay, the king of the Amalekites, and the best of the sheep and cattle, the fat calves and lambs, everything that was good. These they were unwilling to destroy completely. But everything that was despised and weak, they totally destroyed. So he didn't obey again. Okay, he said, hey, this is too good. We shouldn't kill this. We shouldn't kill that. This is too valuable. Okay, but God had said to destroy everything. So Samuel's response, verse 20. Verse 19. Why did you not obey the Lord? Why did you pounce on the plunder and do evil in the eyes of the Lord? But I did obey the Lord, Saul said. I went on the mission the Lord assigned me, and I completely destroyed the Amalekites. And look, I brought back Agag, their king. Well, Agag's alive. Agag was supposed to be dead, right? The soldiers took sheep and cattle from the plunder, the best of what was devoted to God, in order to sacrifice them to Yahweh, your God, at Gilgal. But Samuel replied, does Yahweh delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as much as obeying the voice of Yahweh? To obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed is better than the fat of rams. Okay? Great verse there. to obey is better than sacrifice. That's what God wants, is our obedience. He wants us to follow Him and listen to Him and obey Him. Okay? So another poor discernment, weak spiritual discernment. Then, 1 Samuel chapter 22, verse 17. Then the king ordered the guards at his side, "Turn and kill the priests of the Lord, because they too have sided with David. They knew he was fleeing, yet they didn't tell me." But the king's officials were not willing to raise a hand to strike the priests of Yahweh. In verse 19, he ended up getting this Doeg, the Edomite, and he put down the he put to the sword not only the priests, but the whole town of the priests, Nob, with all its men and women, its children and infants, and its cattle, donkeys, and sheep. So here he was reluctant to destroy all the good stuff of the Amalekites, but didn't think twice about destroying this town of Judah, this town of Israel, with a Levite city, with all these priests and all the people in the city and their livestock and all of that. Why? Because David had gone through there. David had sought some refuge there. And so you see his horrible reaction to these people who basically David had come to inquire of God among these priests. And then chapter 28, verse 5. When Saul saw the Philistine army, he was afraid. Terror filled his heart. He inquired of the Lord, but the Lord did not answer him by dreams or Urim or prophets. Saul then said to his attendants, "Find me a woman who's a medium, so that I may go and inquire of her." There's one in Endor, they said. So when God didn't answer him, because God had rejected him as king at this time, when God didn't answer him, he wanted an answer, so he went to a medium. He called a medium to be able to call up Samuel from the dead to get Samuel's directions here. Okay? Very poor spiritual discernment. Okay, we see he started off so well, even prophesying with the prophets, but he ended so poorly. Well, let's wrap him up here. Chapter 13, verse 1. Okay, it says that Saul was 30 years old when he became king, and he reigned over Israel for 42 years. So he was king quite a while. It wasn't a short reign, okay, from 30 to 72 years old. Okay, but it was not a prime kingship because of his lack of spiritual discernment and not following God as he should. Where did he reign? Chapter 10, verse 26. I mentioned this before, but Saul went to his home in Gibeah, accompanied by valiant men whose hearts God had touched. And you see Gibeah scattered throughout. But that's where he reigned. There was not a national capital like Washington, D.C. in Saul's time. He reigned from his house, from his home. He didn't have a palace. He just had a home. He was more of a warrior than an administrator. There was a lot of war at this time, a lot of battles, a lot of enemies on all sides, and he fought those, and that was his focus as king, is to fight those battles for them. Now let's take a look at some of the first concepts of our picture here. Okay, if you look at the picture, you see the banner entwines itself around and through the crowns. Okay, and this banner has different inscriptions on it. Those inscriptions, the bull, the tent, the serpent, thistle, lion, gate, tree, the burden bearer, ship, fox, mountain goat, and grain, all represent the 12 tribes. Okay, so this banner represents the 12 tribes. And what each of those things represent, if you turn to page 6 of your handout, you'll see all those listed, and that the bull's associated with Ephraim, and you see that with Hosea 10, verse 11. And so you see all the connections there. So this banner represents the 12 tribes. And you see that it entwines itself around and through the crowns, and that reminds us these 12 tribes now were united under kings. Okay, this is the United Kingdom, period. You see the pillars rising from the throne base up to the heavens, and that points out that the kings were selected by God. They were selected by God, not by natural succession like you might have in other kingdoms and other nations where the king's son, oldest son, becomes the next king, and so forth, okay? But these kings were chosen by God. We've already seen that with Saul, and we'll see it with the other two kings, how God chose Saul from among all the people. The crown on the far left is the first king, Saul, the reign of Saul. And you notice that the crown is dark, okay, not very attractive. And Saul's kingship met violent opposition. There was a lot of battle, but also that darkness kind of talks a little bit about his poor spiritual discernment in his kingdom. You see the little summary on the bottom of page 2. Saul was a country boy who died a country boy. Okay, never really became royalty. Okay, but he did lead Israel in their battles and united Israel. So there were some positives there, but the negatives kind of overshadow that. The negatives of his poor spiritual discernment and lack of obedience to God. Now, rather than jumping next into David, which is the next step, we need to talk a little bit about the transition there. We need to talk a little bit about how Saul and David got along, because that's a big, big part of the story. And it's a big part of Saul's story, as well as it's a big part of David's story. So page 3 here, we're going to talk about that interaction there. Now, the first times that we see Saul and David interacting together, one of the early ones is in 1 Samuel 18, verse 2. It says, from that day. Well, what day? Well, if you look at chapter 17, that's the story of Goliath, David and Goliath. So after David defeated Goliath, it says that on that day, from that day on, Saul kept David with him and did not let him return to his father's house. So we see that David moved in with Saul and lived in Saul's home after he had killed Goliath. Okay, he's a national hero now. But there were also other reasons for that. We see in, the next verse, verse 3, Jonathan, Saul's son, made a covenant with David because he loved him as himself. So there's a great friendship between Saul's son, Jonathan, who was the next in line, who would be the successor to Saul, okay, Saul's oldest son, and with David. So there was a great friendship there. But in 16, verse 23, from Saul's perspective, going backwards a little bit, we see whenever the Spirit from God came upon Saul, David would take his harp and play. Then relief would come to Saul. He would feel better and the evil spirit would leave him. So God allowed evil spirits in some way to possess Saul, whether he went crazy, okay, that's kind of what the thought is, or had some physical problems or whatever, but when that would happen, David, who was living there with Saul, would take up the harp and play. He learned how to play the harp in all those long, boring days and nights out watching the sheep, right? And he would play, and that would bring peace and comfort to Saul, and Saul would calm down. And so that was one of the functions that that David served. We also see other functions of mentioned elsewhere that he made him an armor bearer, etc. So here we see Saul and David get to know each other kind of early on, okay, when David's fairly young. How does Saul feel about David? Chapter 18, verse 6. And here we see the twist, okay, with the Goliath victory here. When the men were returning home after David had killed the Philistine, the women came out from all the towns of Israel to meet King Saul with singing and dancing, with joyful songs, with tambourines and lutes. Okay, here's the king coming back after this great victory, and oh, they're going to go praise the king, right? As they danced, they sang, Saul has slain his thousands. Okay, praise to Saul, right? And David, his tens of thousands. Well, Saul was very angry. This refrain galled him. They have credited David with tens of thousands, he thought, but me with only thousands. What more can he get but the kingdom? And from that time on, Saul kept a jealous eye on David. So now we see the problem popping up between Saul and David, and that is this problem of jealousy. And this jealousy is going to get worse as we see that not only is David blessed by God, but God is with David, and Saul gets more and more jealous. We see that even in the next verses, verse 12. Saul was afraid of David because Yahweh was with David, but had left Saul. Okay, remember I'd mentioned that God had rejected Saul because Saul had rejected God. And now God was very clearly with David and very clearly not with Saul. And then starting in verse 28, when Saul realized that Yahweh was with David and that his daughter Michal loved David, Saul became still more afraid of him, and he remained his enemy the rest of his days. So he was afraid of David, and he hated David as a result of it. And from this point on, David was his bitter enemy. He just absolutely hated David. How much so? How did Saul try to solve his perceived threat from David? Verse 10. The next day, an evil spirit from God came forcefully upon Saul. He was prophesying in his house while David was playing the harp, as he usually did. Saul had a spear in his hand, and he hurled it, saying to himself, "I'll pin David to the wall." But David eluded him twice. Twice he tries to kill David by throwing a spear at him. And then chapter 19, verse 9, an evil spirit from the Lord came upon Saul as he was sitting in the house with a spear in his hand while David was playing the harp. Saul tried to pin him to the wall with a spear, but David eluded him as Saul drove the spear into the wall. So he threw it pretty hard for it to go into the wall like this. That night, David made good his escape. It was clear that Saul wanted to kill David. He wanted David out of the picture. And so David left. And so now we don't see David living with Saul anymore, because David is an enemy. Now, in the middle of that, there's some other stuff. Verse 17 of chapter 18. Saul said to David, "Here's my older daughter Merab. I will give her to you in marriage. Only serve me bravely and fight the battles of the Lord." Okay, it sounds like he likes David, right? But look at the rest of that verse. "For Saul said to himself, 'I won't raise a hand against him. Let the Philistines do that. If David marries my daughter, then he is part of the king. And if I send him out into battle, he's part of the king's family, so if I send him out into battle, that's going to put a big target on him, and the Philistines are going to try to kill him. So we'll let him die this way." Okay. And then verse 25. Saul replied, "Say to David, 'The king wants no other price for the bride than 100 Philistine foreskins to take revenge on his enemies.'" Saul's plan was to have David fall by the hands of the Philistines. Okay? So if David wants to marry my daughter, then the price is 100 Philistine foreskins. Well, for him to go out and get that, he's got to go into contact and fight the Philistines, and that's going to put him in line there. The Philistines will know that he's going to marry into the family, and he's going to be a target. So his hope is that David would die in the process of collecting this bride price. Okay? Chapter 19, verse 11. Okay, this is after David made good his escape that we read earlier. Saul sent men to David's house to watch it and to kill him in the morning. Okay? So he sent men to David's house to ambush and to kill him when he got up and left the house in the morning. Okay, an assassination here. But Michal, David's wife, warned him, "If you don't run for your life tonight, tomorrow you will be killed." So even though Michal was Saul's daughter, she loved David and she protected him. Then you've got this neat story about how she puts this idol in the bed, making it look like David was in the bed, and kind of allows David to escape. Verse 15, "Then Saul sent men back to see David and told him, 'Bring him up to me in his bed that I may kill him.'" Okay, since the idol couldn't get out of the bed, Michal told the men, "Oh, David can't come out to play now because he's sick in bed." And Saul said, "Well, go bring the bed with him." Okay, he wanted him dead that much. Then the next chapter, chapter 20, verse 31. Saul's anger flared up, I'll start at verse 30, at Jonathan, and he said, "You son of a perverse and rebellious woman," Jonathan being his son, the heir to the throne, right? "Don't I know that you've sided with the son of Jesse, that is David, to your own shame and to the shame of the mother who bore you? As long as the son of Jesse lives on this earth, neither you nor your kingdom will be established. Now send and bring him to me, for he must die." "Why? Why should he be put to death? What has he done?" Jonathan asked his father. But Saul hurled his spear at him to kill him. Then Jonathan knew that his father intended to kill David. Saul wanted David dead so much that when Jonathan spoke up to protect him, spoke up in David's defense, when Jonathan spoke up in David's defense, Saul tried to kill Jonathan, his own son, the heir to the throne. Okay? This thing of David overtakes Saul, and he's preoccupied with it, and this is a major distraction for him and away from doing what he's supposed to do in terms of being king. You know, we've seen that as part of his kingship was focused on fighting the enemies. But look at what else he does here with his military. Chapter 23, verse 8. Saul called up his forces for battle to go down to Keilah to besiege David and his men. What was Keilah? Keilah was a town in Judah. This was an Israelite town. He was going to destroy this town because David was there. He sent his army to go besiege one of his own towns because he thought David was there. What kind of a king is this? So we've talked about how King Herod at the time of Jesus was super paranoid and stopped at nothing to get rid of any threat to his kingdom. We see that same thing with Saul here. And he's preoccupied and he's focused more on chasing down David than he is about the enemies to Israel and protecting his own nation, what he's supposed to be doing. A couple of other quick examples. Chapter 24, verse 2 says, Saul took 3,000 chosen men from all of Israel and set them out to look for David and his men near the crags of the wild goats. Okay, this is in the desert of En-Gedi. He takes 3,000 men to go find them there. And then a couple chapters later, in chapter 26, verse 2, it says, Saul went down to the desert of Ziph with his 3,000 chosen men of Israel to search there for David. So he takes thousands of men, 3,000 men, a huge group of people to go chase down this guy. Now, David had men with him, but 3,000 chosen, well-trained fighting men. So you see his distraction here. How did David respond to these threats from Saul? Well, let's look at both those chapters to see what happens. Okay. In chapter 24, where Saul took the 3,000 men out to the desert of En-Gedi to chase him down, starting at verse 3. Saul came to the sheep pens along the way. A cave was there, and Saul went in to relieve himself. David and his men were far back in that cave. The men said, "This is the day that the Lord spoke of when he said to you, 'I will give your enemy into your hands for you to deal with as you wish.'" So then David crept up unnoticed and cut off a corner of Saul's robe. While he was there relieving himself in his cave, David sneaks up and cuts off a part of his robe. Afterward, David was conscience-stricken for having cut off a corner of his robe. He said to his men, "Yahweh forbid that I should do such a thing to my master, Yahweh's anointed, or lift my hand against him, for he's the anointed of Yahweh. God has chosen him to be king. How am I to say I should get in the middle of that and get in the way of that?" With these words, David rebuked his men and did not allow them to attack Saul. And Saul left the cave and went on his way. Okay, and we won't read the rest of the story there, but it's very interesting because then David goes out and says, "Saul, look, God delivered you into my hands, and look, I cut off part of your robe. I'm sorry for that, but this is to show you that I am not trying to kill you. Okay, I am not going to kill or harm the Lord's anointed." We see the same sort of thing in chapter 26, starting at verse 7. So David and Abishai was kind of his commanding leader, went to the army by night, and there was Saul lying asleep inside the camp with his spear stuck in the ground near his head. Abner, who's Saul's commander of his army, Abner and the soldiers were lying around him. Abishai said to David, "Today God has delivered your enemy into your hands. Now, let me pin him to the ground with one thrust of my spear. I won't strike him twice. I'll get it done with one quick blow." But David said to Abishai, "Don't destroy him. Who can lay a hand on Yahweh's anointed and be guiltless? As sure as Yahweh lives," he said, "Yahweh himself will strike him. Either his time will come and he'll die, or he'll go into battle and perish. But Yahweh forbid that I should lay a hand on Yahweh's anointed. Now, get the spear and the water jug that are near his head and let's go." So David took the spear and the water jug near Saul's head, and they left. No one saw or knew about it, nor did anyone wake up. They were all sleeping because the Lord had put them into a deep sleep. So here again you see he had the opportunity to kill Saul without anyone knowing about it, And he didn't. He refused to kill or even harm Yahweh's anointed. God had chosen Saul as king. David was not going to go against that. Okay? He said, his time will come, he'll end up dying, or he'll die in battle, something will happen, but it's not for me to do. If God wants him dead, then God will make him dead. It's not for me to decide. So Saul then does die. In the last chapter of 1 Samuel, okay, 1 Samuel chapter 31, he dies in battle against the Philistines, and word of that gets to David. How does David react when he hears that Saul, the man who's chased him over all creation, trying to kill him, has died himself? 2 Samuel 1, verse 11. Then David and all the men with him took hold of their clothes and tore them. They mourned and wept and fasted until evening for Saul and his son Jonathan and for the army of Yahweh and for the house of Israel because they had fallen by the sword. David said to the young man, who brought this report of Saul's death? Where are you from? I'm the son of an alien, an Amalekite, he answered. David asked him, why were you not afraid to lift your hand to destroy Yahweh's anointed? Okay, and we skipped the part where this man came and said that he had killed Saul. Saul had been wounded in battle, and he was dying, and he asked this guy to kill him, and he did. Okay, and David says, why were you not afraid to lift your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed? Then David called one of his men and said, go strike him down. So he struck him down and he died. For David had said to him, your blood be on your own head. For your own mouth testified against you when you said that I killed Yahweh's anointed. So not the kind of reaction people would have expected. In fact, this guy who brought news of Saul's death probably thought he was going to get a reward and get praised by David for killing David's enemy. But instead, he loses his life for having killed the Lord's anointed, for having killed Saul. Okay, totally different kind of reaction there than what he expected. Okay, let's go back a little bit into that last chapter, chapter 31, starting at verse 11. When the people of Jabesh-Gilead, okay, remember Jabesh-Gilead was that town on the eastern side of the Jordan that Saul went and defended against the Ammonites at the very beginning of his kingship, right? That really kind of kicked off his kingship. And so they felt like they owed a debt to Saul, right? So when the people of Jabesh-Gilead heard what the Philistines had done to Saul, which if you look at the prior verses, it says that when the Philistines came to strip the dead, they found Saul and his three sons fallen. So they cut off his head, stripped off his armor, and sent messengers throughout the land of Philistines to proclaim the news. They put his armor in the temple of the Ashtoreth and fashioned his body, as well as his son's body, to the wall of Bethshan. So when the men of Jabesh-Gilead heard what the Philistines had done to Saul, all of their valiant men journeyed through the night to Bethshan. Okay? They took down the bodies of Saul and his sons from the wall of Bethshan and went to Jabesh, where they burned them so that the Philistines couldn't get them again. Then they took their bones and buried them under the tamarisk tree at Jabesh, and they fasted 7 days. So you see what the men of Jabesh-Gilead did. Then, in response to that, chapter 2 of 2 Samuel, starting at the second half, verse 4, when David was told that it was the men of Jabesh-Gilead who had buried Saul, he sent messengers to the men of Jabesh-Gilead to say to them, Yahweh bless you for showing this kindness to Saul your master by burying him. May Yahweh now show you kindness and faithfulness, and I too will show you the same favor because you have done this. Now then, be strong and brave, for Saul your master is dead, and the house of Judah has just anointed me king over them. So he thanked, he sent messengers to thank and praise the men of Jabesh-Gilead for what they had done out of their respect for Saul. They risked their own lives going into this Philistine town and this Philistine temple to get his body. All right? Now, there's also deaths in Saul's house as a response, okay? Just like we saw the Amalekite who had come and told David that Saul was dead, thinking that that would be good news. Well, there's other things like that that happen, and how does David react to these other deaths? Chapter 3, verse 30. Joab and his brother Abishai murdered Abner. Okay, remember, Abner was the commander of Saul's army. Joab was the commander of David's army. And Abishai was Joab's brother and partners with Joab there. They murdered Abner because Abner had killed their brother Asahel in the battle at Gibeon. Then David said to Joab and all the people with him, tear your clothes and put on sackcloth and walk in mourning in front of Abner. King David himself walked behind the bier. They buried Abner in Hebron, and the king wept aloud at Abner's tomb. All the people wept also. And then verse 35, then they all came and urged David to eat something while it was still day. But David took an oath, saying, may God deal with me, be it ever so severely, if I taste bread or anything else before the sun sets. And then verse 38, then the king said to his men, do you not realize that a prince and a great man has fallen in Israel this day? So what does he do? He condemned Abner's murderer and mourned. Mourned the loss of Abner, Abner being the commander of Saul's army who worked so hard to try to kill David all those years. But he mourned that loss because he was part of God's chosen kingdom there. And then the next chapter, chapter 4, verse 8, it says, and this has to do with Ishbosheth. In fact, we kind of see that a little bit sooner, but Ishbosheth is one of Saul's sons, and he seems to be the natural choice to be the next king, since Jonathan has died in battle with Saul, and other sons had died. So Ishbosheth is proclaimed king. And then verse 8, they brought the head of Ishbosheth to David at Hebron and said to the king, here's the head of Ishbosheth, son of Saul, your enemy who tried to take your life. This day Yahweh has avenged my lord the king against Saul and his offspring. So these group of men went and killed Ishbosheth and brought his head to David, thinking David would be pleased, right? And what happens? Verse 12, David gave an order to his men and they killed them. They cut off their hands and feet and hung their bodies by the pool in Hebron. But they took the head of Ishbosheth and buried it in Abner's tomb at Hebron. So he ended up killing those who had murdered Saul's son, thinking that they were doing something good for David. But instead, he shows that it is not in his hand to get rid of Saul's family. Okay. And then one more, chapter 9 of 2 Samuel. There's one more member of Saul's family left, and a guy named Mephibosheth who was a cripple. Okay, he had been injured when his nurse dropped him when he was young. And David tells him in verse 7 of chapter 9, don't be afraid, for I will surely show you kindness for the sake of your father Jonathan. And see, this is Jonathan's son, so it's the last member of the family here. I will restore to you all the land that belonged to your grandfather Saul, and you will always eat at my table. So he gave him all of Saul's land, didn't keep any of it for himself, and he said, I'm going to take care of you the rest of your life. So he was protected. Okay. So it was very clear to all the people that David had not tried to kill Saul, no matter how much Saul had tried to kill David, that David was not going to raise a hand against Saul, that David was accepting what God gave him, but he wasn't taking it from Saul. Okay. And he didn't go and try to do the normal thing that a new king in a nation would do, and that is to purge the prior king's family, to get rid of them so that there's no threats. In fact, when someone did something like that against Saul's family, he was very clearly upset with that and displeased with that and punished those who would do such a thing. Okay? So there we have the transition between Saul and David. Now, let's talk a little bit more about David. Hey, page 4. Okay, you're like, I told you this is going to be a long one today here. There's quite a bit of ground to cover. But you know that page 3 with the whole David and Saul thing, that tells you a whole lot about what was going on at the time. And the whole relationship between Saul and David had a lot to do with Saul's relationship with God and David's relationship with God. And tells us a lot about that. So, talk about David. Okay, David's the second king. How did Samuel know who God wanted to become the second king of Israel? Did he decide, God gave him power over Goliath to bring this victory against the Philistines, and that's telling me that God has chosen David to be the next king? No, because that story is where, okay, remember your memory concepts, in 1 Samuel 17. And if we go back to 1 Samuel 16, look what happens. The Lord Yahweh said to Samuel, how long will you mourn for Saul since I've rejected him as king over Israel? Fill your horn with oil and be on your way. I'm sending you to Jesse of Bethlehem. I've chosen one of his sons to be king. But Samuel said, how can I go? Saul will hear about it and kill me. Yahweh said, well, take a heifer with you and say, I've come to sacrifice to Yahweh. Invite Jesse to the sacrifice and I'll show you what to do. You're to anoint for me the one that I indicate. So how did Samuel know? He didn't. God showed him. God brought him to him. And in fact, if you read the story, which we don't have time to do today, when he goes there and he sees these sons of Jesse, he's going, ah, yeah, this guy looks like a king. And he goes to anoint him. God says, nope, it's not him. I said, okay, what about the next one looks good too. And he ends up with the run of the litter is the one that God had chosen, David. And so God chose the second king, just like he had chose the first king. And God sent Samuel to David and showed David to him. And then verse 13, we see Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed David in the presence of his brothers. And from that day on, the Spirit of Yahweh came upon David in power. Samuel then went to Ramah. So all of David's brothers saw this, okay, but it wasn't in front of a whole group of people. And then they just go back to their normal lives, right? And we do have at the end of chapter 16 where Saul's tormented by this evil spirit and word comes about this shepherd boy who's able to play the harp. And so he's brought in as one of the musicians to come and soothe Saul. And this is before the Goliath thing. Now, he starts that, but then he goes back and we see him then at the beginning of chapter 17 shepherding his father's sheep some more. And that's when he then goes out to the battlefield to take some snacks and food or whatever to his brothers and meets up with the whole Goliath story. Okay. So this is all before that. And his brothers have seen that he's been anointed by Samuel as the next king. And you kind of see that in the David and Goliath story when he comes there. If you go on to chapter 17, you see that when David goes out to the field and he hears what Goliath is shouting, all the curses that Goliath is shouting against God and God's people, David asked the men standing there in verse 26, what will be done for the man who kills this Philistine and removes this disgrace from Israel? Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? And then in verse 28, when Eliab, David's oldest brother, heard him speaking with the men, he burned with anger and said, why have you come down here? And with whom did you leave those few sheep in the desert? I know how conceited you are and how wicked your heart is. You came down only to watch the battle. Okay. So here, his brother is already jealous for David being chosen as king. And you kind of see some of that coming through in this conversation here. Well, did others recognize David to be heir to the throne? He was chosen by God, but it's not until we get to 2 Samuel when David becomes king. So during the stories of 1 Samuel, when Saul is king, do other people recognize, other than, say, David's brothers, recognize that David's going to be the next king? Look at chapter 23, verse 16. Says, Saul's son Jonathan went to David at Horesh and helped him find strength in God. Don't be afraid, he said. My father Saul will not lay a hand on you. You're going to be king over Israel, and I'll be second to you. Even my father Saul knows this. So Jonathan, David's good friend, the son of Saul, the first son of Saul, the one who's supposed to be the next king, he knew that David would be the next king, and he was fine with it. He said, I'll be second to you. Okay. And then chapter 24, verse 16, this is after David cuts off the part of the robe instead of killing Saul. And when David finished telling Saul about it, in verse 16, he says, is that your voice, David, my son? And he wept aloud. You're more righteous than I am, he goes on in verse 17. But then verse 20, I know that you will surely be king and that the kingdom of Israel will be established in your hands. So even Saul knew it. Jonathan and Saul knew that David was going to be the next king. Okay, back in then when he does become king, do the Israelites readily accept David as Saul's successor? Chapter 2, first part of verse 4. Then the men of Judah came to Hebron, and there they anointed David as king over the house of Judah. So we see that the southern tribe of Judah did. Where was David from? He was from Bethlehem, which is a town in Judah. So his own tribe accepted him as king, but we don't see the other ones doing so. Okay, look at verses 8 and 9. It says, meanwhile, Abner, son of Ner, the commander of Saul's army, had taken Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, and brought him over to Mahanaim, and he made him king over Gilead, Ashuri, and Jezreel, and also over all of Israel. And he reigned there for 2 years. So Saul's son Ishbosheth was made king over the rest of Israel. So now we see a divided kingdom. It's no longer already, after the first king, it's a divided kingdom. You've got Judah in the south accepting David, and then the other tribes in the north accepting Ishbosheth. And so we now have two nations, no longer united. But then, after Ishbosheth dies and Abner dies, in those stories that we kind of glanced at earlier, chapter 5, verse 4, we see that David was 30 years old when he became king, and he reigned for 40 years. In Hebron, he reigned over Judah for 7 years and 6 months, and then in Jerusalem, he reigned over all of Israel and Judah for 33 years. He was 30 years old, just like Saul had been. He reigned for 40 years, okay, so he was 70, a little 2 years shorter than Saul. But of those 40 years, the first seven were just over the southern tribe of Judah. Okay, it wasn't until he was 37 and a half then that he took over all of Israel, and he had all of Israel for 33 years, and Israel then became a united kingdom again. Where did he reign? It says both in Hebron and in Jerusalem. Now, I read the wrong verses there, but it kind of gave some of the same answer. But let's go back and read the verses I missed. Chapter 5, verse 1. All the tribes of Israel came to David at Hebron and said, we're your own flesh and blood. In the past, while Saul was king over you, you were the one who led Israel on their military campaigns. And Yahweh said to you that you will shepherd my people Israel, and you'll become their ruler. So when all the elders of Israel had come to King David at Hebron, the king made a compact with them at Hebron before the Lord, and they anointed David king over Israel. So that's where we see he then became king over all of Israel, after first being king just over Judah for 7.5 years. Okay, let's talk about David's highlights and lowlights, kind of like we did with Saul earlier. Turn back to 1 Samuel chapter 18, starting at verse 5. And the question is, how did God bless David as a soldier? We saw that Saul's kingship was focused on being a soldier, focused on being a military leader. What about for David? Chapter 18, verse 5 says that whatever Saul sent him to do, okay, this is when Saul was still king, David did it so successfully that Saul gave him a high rank in the army. This pleased all the people and Saul's officers as well. And this is before the jealousy started, but he went out and fought the battles for Saul and fought the battles for the nation, and God gave him great success. God was with him. We see in verse 14, in everything he did, he had great success because Yahweh was with him. And then verse 30, the Philistine commanders continued to go out to battle, and as often as they did, David met with more success than the rest of Saul's officers, and his name became well known. So he had great success as David had great success as a military leader. Why? Because God was with him. Okay? God was with him. Key part of David's success, or as a person, not just as a military leader, and a key differentiator between him and Saul. And then 27, verses 8 to 9. David and his men went up and raided the Geshurites, the Gerzites, and the Amalekites. From ancient times, these people had lived in the land extending to Shur and Egypt. Whenever David attacked an area, he did not leave a man or woman alive, but took sheep and cattle, donkeys and camels and clothes. And then he returned to Achish. So here we see his successes against these various ites that during the time that before he was king, when he and his partners could just hang around, but instead they went clearing out these other peoples that had not been cleared out during the conquest. Okay, continued to do God's work over the enemies within Israel there. And then 2 Samuel chapter 8, verses 11 and 12, King David dedicated these articles to the Lord as he had done with the silver and gold from the nations he had subdued. Those nations included Edom and Moab, the Ammonites, the Philistines, and Amalek. He also dedicated the plunder taken from Hadadezer, son of Rehob, king of Zobah. And you can read a little bit more about some of that in the prior verses in there in chapter 8. So, he was victorious over his enemies on every side. Okay? Everywhere he went. God gave him victories. Why? Because God was with him and God gave him victories. Why was God with him? Well, that kind of gets to the next question. How insightful was David spiritually? Well, let's start early on. Let's go to this chapter 17 of 1 Samuel. And what is that story? That's the story of David and Goliath, right? Your memory concept. Chapter 17, verse 36. Your servant has killed both the lion and the bear. This uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them because he has defied the armies of the living God. So why did he feel like he could be successful against this huge giant Goliath that scared everybody else? Because God would give him success. It wasn't going to be David's strength and might and power. In fact, they tried to put all this armor on him and give him weapons, and he said, no, it's not going to be my victory, it's God's victory. And so he kills him with a slingshot and a rock. Okay? And so here you see his trust in God and his recognition of what God wants, his discernment there. Okay? Let's turn a few pages to chapter 23, verse 2. He inquired of the Lord, saying, shall I go and attack these Philistines? The Lord answered him, go, attack the Philistines and save Keilah. And then verse 4 of the same chapter. Once again, David inquired of the Lord, and the Lord answered him, go down to Keilah, for I'm going to give the Philistines into your hand. And then turn a few more chapters to chapter 30 and verse 8. We see David inquired of the Lord, shall I pursue this raiding party? Will I overtake them? Pursue them, he answered. You will certainly overtake them and succeed in the rescue. So here we see that whenever he went to fight in the battle, he didn't do so based on his own strategies and his own plan and his own power, but rather he always inquired of God. He was a man after God's heart. He wanted to know God's heart, and he asked God's heart. He inquired of God's heart before he went into battle. Unlike his predecessor Saul, right, who went and did things on his own and was impetuous and impulsive. Chapter 25, verse 39. When David heard that Nabal was dead, he said, praise be to the Lord who has upheld my cause against Nabal for treating me with contempt. He's kept his servant from doing wrong and has brought Nabal's wrongdoing down on his own head. So he had this guy named Nabal who is a real jerk and created a lot of problems for David, and David was justified in attacking Nabal, but he didn't. And he left it to God, and God allowed Nabal to die. And so David, and we saw that with Saul too. David did not want to lift his hand up when it was up to God to do something. Okay, and he looked to God for God to do his will, and rather than him taking charge on it. So he thanked God for stopping his attack on Nabal and for punishing Nabal himself. And then one more we'll look at in 2 Samuel chapter 7, verses 1 and 2. After the king was settled in his palace and the Lord had given him rest from all his enemies around him, okay, so we brought some peace to the nation, he said to Nathan the prophet, look, here I am living in a palace of cedar while the ark of God remains in a tent. And then he goes on, and basically what does he want to do? He wants to build a temple to God. Okay? He wanted to build God's house. But then you see in the following verses that God says, no, you're not going to be the one to do it, but your kingdom, your house and your kingdom, verse 16, will endure forever before me. Your throne will be established forever. So God blessed him as a result of his faithfulness to God. Okay? You see what he wanted to do. He was a man after God's heart, as we've said before. All right? So, he was insightful spiritually, okay, sought after God. How influential was he with others? Chapter 24, verse 16. When David finished saying this, Saul asked, is that your voice, David, my son? And he wept aloud. You're more righteous than I, he said. You've treated me well, and I've treated you badly. You've just now told me of the good that you did to me. Yahweh delivered me into your hands, but you didn't kill me. When a man finds his enemy, does he let him get away unharmed? May Yahweh reward you well for the way that you treated me today. I know that you'll surely be king and that the kingdom of Israel will be established in your hands. So here we see when he didn't kill Saul, instead he cut the edge of his garment off to prove that he could have, Saul praised him. Okay? And Saul didn't kill him, which is what was on Saul's mind every part of every day. We see it again in chapter 26, verse 21. Saul said, I've sinned. Come back, David, my son, because you considered my life precious today. I will not try to harm you again. Surely I've acted like a fool and have erred greatly. And that was when David could have killed Saul when he took Saul's spear and water jug. He could have killed him very easily, and he didn't. And Saul recognizes that. Okay? And Saul didn't kill him as he could have, as he had longed to over and over and over again. All right. Chapter 21, verse 10. That day David fled from Saul and went to Achish, king of Gath. But the servants of Achish said to him, isn't this David, the king of the land? Isn't he the one that they sing about in their dances, that Saul slain his thousands and David his tens of thousands? Okay, so here he's in Philistine territory. Okay, king of Gath, that's one of the Philistine kings. And so David goes there, and Achish's leaders are concerned. Hey, I don't know. This guy shouldn't be around here. We shouldn't let him in this country. This is a dangerous guy. David took these words to heart and was very much afraid of Achish, king of Gath. So he pretended to be insane in their presence. And while he was in their hands, he acted like a madman, making marks on the door of the gate and letting saliva run down his beard. Achish said to his servants, look at the man. He's insane. Why bring him to me? Am I so short of madmen that you have to bring this fellow here to carry on like this in front of me? Must this man come into my house? Okay. So there he was allowed to stay in Gath. But then we see it changes a little bit further in chapter 27, verse 6. On that day, Achish gave David Ziklag a town, and it belonged to the kings of Judah ever since. David lived in Philistine territory for a year and 4 months. In verse 12, Achish trusted David and said to himself, he's become so odious to his people, the Israelites, that he will be my servant forever. In that chapter is where David deceived Achish by saying, when Achish says, hey, where have you been? He says, oh, I've been destroying all these Judah towns, okay, these towns of the Israelites. But when he was actually going out and destroying all these other peoples. And so in both cases, he deceived Achish and won Achish's favor. Okay, so that he could stay in Philistine territory for quite a while, but not only that, but was even given a town. Okay, and this was a town in the enemy country of Philistia. All right, chapter 30, verse 26. When David arrived in Ziklag, he sent some of the plunder to the elders of Judah, who were his friends, saying, here's a present for you from the plunder of the Lord's enemies. So here he had chased down the Amalekites who had come and taken his wife and children and his goods and all that and other people from Judah. And after his victory, he kept what was his, but he gave the plunder and gave it to the other people of Judah and won their heart as well. Then chapter 2 of 2 Samuel, starting at verse 4. The men of Judah came to Hebron, and there they anointed David king over the house of Judah. When David was told it was the men of Jabesh-Gilead who had buried Saul, he sent messengers to the men of Jabesh-Gilead to say to them, the Lord bless you for showing this kindness to Saul your master by burying him. May the Lord now show you kindness and faithfulness, and I too will show you the same favor because you have done this. Now then, be strong and brave, for Saul your master is dead, and the house of Judah has anointed me king over them. Now we've read this before, but again, you see his relationship with these people. He praises the people of Jabesh-Gilead for the kindness that they showed to Saul by taking his body off the wall of the Philistine temple and burying it properly and all of that. Okay, so you see that David was very influential with others. The other stuff that we've also kind of talked about, we'll read a few verses here, chapter 1, verse 11. David and all his men with him took hold of their clothes and tore them. They mourned and wept and fasted until evening for Saul and his son Jonathan and for the army of the Lord and for the house of Israel because they had fallen by the sword. So you see his reaction when his enemy Saul, or what everybody thought was his enemy Saul, was killed. Okay? This mourning and fasting and being upset about what happened. And then chapter 3, verse 31, David said to Joab and all the people with him, tear your clothes and put on sackcloth and walk in mourning in front of Abner. Okay, this is after Joab had killed Abner, the commander of Saul's army. And verse 36, all the people took note and were pleased. Indeed, everything the king did pleased them. So on that day, all the people and all Israel knew that the king had no part in the murder of Abner, son of Ner. Okay. So you see, by what he did naturally out of his concern for God's anointed, led to people, him being endeared to the people. Chapter 4, verse 8. They brought the head of Ishbosheth to David at Hebron and said to him, here's the head of Ishbosheth, son of Saul, your enemy, who tried to take your life. This day the Lord has avenged my lord, the king, against Saul and his offspring. And in verse 12, so David gave an order to his men and they killed them. They cut off their hands and feet and hung the bodies by the pool in Hebron. But they took the head of Ishbosheth and buried it in Abner's tomb at Hebron. So here you see the concern he had over Saul's family. And what he did in response to these people who had killed Ishbosheth, thinking that that was helping David. Okay? So he was concerned about uniting Israel. He did not force himself as king upon Israel. Okay, we'll see that change with future kings. But instead, he accepted what God gave him. And when God gave him the northern tribes as well, he did what he could to endear himself to those people so that they would accept him, not only because he was the Lord's anointed, but also because they wanted to accept him and that he was a godly ruler for them. Now, one of the things that he did, remember, where did Saul rule from? His own hometown of Gibeah, there in Benjamin, okay, in a specific tribe. David did something, again, politically correct here. He made the national capital, he set up a national capital and did so in a neutral place. And where is that? 2 Samuel chapter 5, starting in verse 5. In Hebron, he reigned over Judah for 7 years and 6 months. Okay, so when he was reigning over Judah, he reigned from Hebron, which is a town in Judah. But then, when he was made king over all of Israel, it says, he then reigned in Jerusalem over all of Israel and Judah for 33 years. The king and his men marched to Jerusalem to attack the Jebusites who lived there. Okay, the Jebusites were some of these Canaanites that were still around, and they were living in this city of Jerusalem, which was a heavily fortified city. And it was right on the border between Judah and Benjamin. So neither Judah or Benjamin had tried to take it because it was right on the border. So it was a neutral territory, Judah being the tribe to the south that David was from, and Benjamin being the first tribe of all the other tribes to the north end of Judah. And so he takes Jerusalem, and they attack the Jebusites. The Jebusites said to David, you can't get in here. Even the blind and the lame can ward you off. They thought David can't get in here because it's a huge fortress. Nevertheless, David did capture the fortress of Zion, the city of David. And then verse 9, David then took up residence in the fortress and called it the city of David. He built up the area around it from the supporting terraces inward. And then chapter 6, verse 17, they brought the ark of the Lord and set it in its place inside the tent that David had pitched for it. And David sacrificed burnt offerings and fellowship offerings before the Lord. So David conquered Jerusalem from the Canaanites that were there and set that up as the national political capital and the national spiritual capital. He moved there, put the government there. He moved the Ark of the Covenant and the Tent of Tabernacle and moved the altar and all of that there. And so brought all that to this neutral place called Jerusalem, which happened to be, by the way, the same place where Abraham had been called to go sacrifice Isaac so many, 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 many years before. All right? So those are some highlights of David. What about lowlights? What was David's greatest lowlight? What was his greatest mistake? 2 Samuel chapter 12. Actually, the story is in chapter 11, okay? But, and that is the story of David with Bathsheba. And let's just look at verses 9 and 10 of chapter 12. This is Nathan the prophet bringing God's word to David. And he says, "Why do you despise the word of the Lord by doing what is evil in his eyes? You struck down Uriah the Hittite with a sword and took his wife to be your own. You killed him with the sword of the Ammonites. Now therefore the sword will never depart from your house because you despised me and took the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your own." His head got too big. He stole someone else's wife and he killed that man to try to cover it up. What a horrible thing to do. And that was a big, big problem for David. That was his greatest error, greatest mistake. And he didn't think anything of it. And Nathan had to bring this thing about this story of this traveler who came and this rich man and the sheep and all that. If you haven't read it, read it. Chapter 12, very interesting. And if you haven't read chapter 11, the whole story of David and Bathsheba, read it. Very interesting. Okay. That was his biggest mistake. And it says the sword will never depart from your family. So what is that referring to? What kind of problems pop up in David's family? Well, let's go and continue in further chapters. Chapter 13, it happens real quick soon thereafter. Chapter 13, verse 1, we see that in the course of time, Amnon, who was a son of David, fell in love with Tamar, the beautiful sister of Absalom, who was also a son of David. In other words, David's daughter, Tamar. So Amnon fell in love with his sister, okay, obviously to a different mother, but the same father, fell in love with Tamar. And then verse 14, a lot of interesting story that I'm skipping here. So if you haven't read it, read it, okay? But he refused to listen to her, and since he was stronger than her, he raped her. Then Amnon hated her with intense hatred. In fact, he hated her more than he had loved her. Amnon said to her, "Get up and get out." So here we see early, soon thereafter, after the whole infidelity, the whole thing of David killing Uriah the Hittite to get Bathsheba, later on, one of his own sons does the same sort of thing. He doesn't control himself from his passion, and he rapes his sister. And then he hates her and gets rid of her, okay, which is, both of those things are unheard of in that culture. Should be in this culture, too. And then, that leads to the next problem. Verse 32, Jonadab, son of Shimeah, David's brother, said, "My lord should not think that they killed all the princes. Only Amnon is dead. This has been Absalom's express intention ever since the day Amnon raped his sister Tamar." Okay, may the Lord the king not be concerned about the report that all the king's sons are dead. Only Amnon is dead. So Absalom, Tamar's brother, killed his brother Amnon for raping his sister Tamar. Okay, and then it goes further. Chapter 15, verse 10 says, "Absalom sent secret messengers throughout all the tribes of Israel to say, as soon as you hear the sound of the trumpets, then say, Absalom is king in Hebron." But I thought David was king. Right, David's still around. But Absalom decides to make himself king, and he does so in Hebron, which is where? That's where David had started out as king for his first 7.5 years before he had moved to Jerusalem. And so Absalom gets this big head, makes himself king, and verse 13, a messenger came and told David, "The hearts of the men of Israel are with Absalom." Okay, so David then has to kind of run away, and you've got a lot of stories in here. But then also to kind of cement the deal, chapter 16, verse 22, we see that they pitched a tent for Absalom on the roof, and he lay with his father's concubines in the sight of all of Israel to prove that he was now king, that what was my father's when my father was king is now mine because I am now the king. Within his own family, David is threatened, his kingship is threatened, and he's got a coup within his own family, his own son, Absalom. Okay? So there we see problems within his family. And then let's go a little bit further to 1 Kings. Okay? In 1 Kings, now just as when we went from, okay, this is a quick little lesson on the books of the Bible here. When you go from Joshua to Judges, you go from Joshua being the leader of Israel, and then you've got Judges being leaders, right? And you go from Judges to 1 Samuel, and then you go from these local judges to this central judge, Samuel, who is now the judge of all of Israel. Then you go, and within 1 Samuel, that we then have the first king of Saul. When you go from 1 Samuel to 2 Samuel, you then go from Saul being king to David being king. Then when we go from 2 Samuel to 1 Kings, we go from David being king to Solomon, his son, being king. Okay, and the stories that kind of go around that. All right. Now, the 1 Kings and 2 Kings kind of division is, it revolves more around Elijah and Elisha and Ahab, and that'll make all more sense to you in a couple of weeks when we talk, 2, 3, 4 weeks as we talk about the other kings. Okay. So if we go to 1 Kings chapter 1 verse 5, we see that Adonijah, whose mother was Haggith, okay, Adonijah was another son of David, he put himself forward and said, "I'll be king." So he got chariots and horses ready with 50 men to run ahead of him, okay, make himself look important. And then verse 17, this is Bathsheba coming to David, because David hadn't died yet. He says, "My Lord, you yourself swore to me, your servant, by the Lord your God, that Solomon your son shall be king after me, and he'll sit on my throne. But now Adonijah has become king, and you, my Lord, don't know anything about it." So his son Adonijah, it wasn't just Absalom, but now Adonijah makes himself king, even while David's still king. And David has already said that the next king's going to be Solomon. So Solomon was the heir, even though Solomon wasn't the oldest, and we'll talk more about that in the next page. One other thing, one other trouble that we see with David is in 2 Samuel chapter 24, and there we see he takes a census, which doesn't sound like a big deal. I mean, we take censuses every 10 years here, right? But in verse 10, it says that David was conscience-stricken after he had counted the fighting men. He said to the Lord, "I've sinned greatly in what I've done. Now, O Lord, I beg you, take away the guilt of your servant. I've done a very foolish thing." Why? Why? What was wrong with David taking a census for the military? Well, it was showing a lack of trust in God. He was counting his own power. He was looking to himself for power rather than looking to God for power. Remember the story of Gideon and how Gideon raised up this big army, and God kept whittling that down from 30,000 to 300, 1% of what he had started out with, or less than 1%, and to show that the victory is God's. "It's not by your power, but by mine, says the Lord." And David realized that after he had taken account of his own power. And so that was another problem that he had. Okay. Now, a few more concepts, if we look at the picture again. We see the crown in the center. Okay, now this crown looks a lot better than the one on the left. And this is refers to the reign of David, the second king. You see the Star of David, the mace, and the light over the crown. And that points out to us that David's reign was the golden age for Israel. In fact, today, Jews look back at that being the pinnacle of their history. When they're looking for a Messiah to come, okay, for God to bring this new king, it's going to be a king like David. Because David was a man after God's own heart. David showed what it was like living in a relationship with God, having a nation living in a relationship with God, and brought that. So this was the golden age. Three diamonds and one dark pearl on the crown are talking about four major events in David's reign. Okay, the first diamond reminds us that he made Jerusalem the capital city of Israel. He took this neutral place, made it the capital city, not just the capital city for national political reasons, but also for spiritual reasons, and brought the house of God there, and Jerusalem is what the Israelites look to this day as being the place, the center city for all of for them. All right, the second diamond, the Philistine menace and other political threats were removed. David brought a time of peace. Okay, there was quite a bit of warfare at the beginning of his reign, but through that warfare, the Lord fought with him, and he was victorious and brought success and brought peace to Israel. The third diamond, Jerusalem was made the religious center of the nation. Okay, so we've got it as a political center in the first diamond, and now the religious center in the third diamond. And then the dark pearl, Disunity in the kingdom resulted from David's sin with Bathsheba. All the troubles that we looked at there towards the end of 2 Samuel and the first part of 1 Kings, those troubles resulted as a result of David's sin with Bathsheba and killing Uriah the Hittite and taking things into his own hand rather than trusting God to continue to bless him as God had done so much. One last thing on David we see at the bottom of page 4 is that David was a country boy who died an urban man with the country still in him. A country boy who died an urban man with the country still in him. All right, and then that brings us to the last one, Solomon. Okay? Now, Solomon became king. Who chose Solomon as king? Well, if you look at some of the verses in 2 Samuel, 1 Kings, and all that, you know, we see David saying that Solomon's going to be king and all that. So did David choose it? Well, let's look at 1st and 2nd Chronicles, okay, or 1st Chronicles, really. 1st and 2nd Chronicles really go along the same lines as 2nd Samuel through 2nd Kings. The stories that we have in 2nd Samuel, 1st Kings, and 2nd Kings are focused on the entire nation of Israel, whereas the stories in 1st and 2nd Chronicles are focused more so on the southern nation of Judah, okay? So we get a little bit more detail on the southern nation of Judah. That doesn't make a lot of sense to you right now, but it will in a few weeks when we talk about the divided kingdom, okay? Right now we're talking about the United Kingdom. But there's some stuff in 1 Chronicles chapter 28, starting at verse 4, it says, this is David speaking and recounting this, and he says, Yahweh, the God of Israel, chose me from my whole family to be king over Israel forever. He chose Judah as leader, and from the house of Judah, He chose my family, and for my father's sons, he was pleased to make me king over all of Israel. Of all my sons, the Lord has given me many. He has chosen my son Solomon to sit on the throne of the kingdom of the Lord over Israel. So, I'll read on a little further. He said to me, Solomon, your son is the one who will build my house and my courts, for I have chosen him to be my son, and I will be his father. I will establish his kingdom forever if he's unswerving in carrying out my commands and laws as is being done at this time. So God chose Solomon. Solomon was not the oldest son. Okay? He was not the natural succession according to the way things were done back then. But rather God chose him. God in his grace chose Solomon. And so David didn't choose Solomon. God did. When David said Solomon is the next king, all he was doing was saying, this is what God has told me. And so we're going to follow what God has said. So how did all that then happen? How did Solomon become king? Okay, 1 Kings chapter 1, verse 39. Zadok the priest took the horn of oil from the sacred tent and anointed Solomon. Then they sounded the trumpet and all the people shouted, Long live King Solomon. Now this is before David had died. David had not died, so Solomon didn't take over when David died. He took over while David was still around. And that's kind of interesting. And why? Well, because if you remember this whole story in 1 Kings chapter 1, is this other son of David, Adonijah, had set himself up as king. And then Bathsheba, we read these verses, came and said, David, I thought you said that my son Solomon was going to be king. And here Adonijah set himself up to be king. So David right away put a stop to that by anointing Zadok the priest anoint Solomon as king and announce that throughout the kingdom and having Solomon become king even while David was around. Was Solomon readily accepted by the people? Verse 47. The royal officials have come to congratulate our Lord King David, saying, May your God make Solomon's name more famous than yours and his throne greater than yours. And the king bowed in worship on his bed and said, Praise be to the Lord, the God of Israel, who has allowed my eyes to see a successor on my throne today. Okay. So yes, officials came and blessed Solomon to David. David thanked God for choosing Solomon and for putting Solomon in place while David was still around. So it wasn't a violent takeover or any of that, such as what Adonijah was trying to do. What instructions did David give to Solomon? Well, chapter 2 is just starts out with a lot of these instructions. We'll just read a few of them. Verse 1, when the time drew near for David to die, he gave a charge to Solomon his son. I'm about to go the way of all the earth, he said, so be strong. Show yourself a man and observe what the Lord your God requires. Walk in his ways and keep his decrees and commands, his laws and requirements as written in the law of Moses, so that you may prosper in all that you do and wherever you go. And that the Lord may keep his promise to me. If your descendants watch how they live, and if they walk faithfully before me in all their, with all their heart and soul, you will never fail to have a man on the throne of Israel. So he charged Solomon to follow God. Follow God, and he will grant you success. He will bless you. He will bless your descendants. He will continue our dynasty forever, he promises. Okay? Which he has, but through a different route than what David might be expecting. That is through Jesus Christ, right? So he gave these charges to Solomon. Follow God. Obey him. He'll bless you. And then he also made some personal requests going on. Now, you yourself know what Joab, the son of Zeruiah, did to me. What he did to the two commanders of Israel's armies, Abner, son of Ner, and Amasa, son of Jether. He killed them, shedding their blood in peacetime as if in battle. And with that blood stained the belt around his waist and the sandals on his feet. Deal with him according to your wisdom, but don't let his gray head go down to the grave in peace. But show kindness to the sons of Barzillai of Gilead, and let them be among those who eat at your table. They stood by me when I fled from your brother Absalom. And remember, you have with you Shimei, son of Gera, the Benjamite from Bahurim, who called down bitter curses on me the day I went to Mahanaim. When he came down to meet me at the Jordan, I swore to him by the Lord, I will not put you to death by the sword. But now, don't consider him innocent. You're a man of wisdom. You know what to do to him. Bring his gray head down to the grave in blood. Okay, so he gave him some of his own dirty laundry to deal with, right? He said, you take care of Joab and take care of Shimei, but be kind to the men of Barzillai. So he gave him some personal kind of things to take care of. Well, did Solomon honor David's request? Well, let's go on. Chapter 2, verse 25. King Solomon gave orders to Benaiah, son of Jehoiada, and he struck down Adonijah, and he died. Okay, so this is Adonijah, who had tried to become king. This is Solomon's brother who tried to become king, and Solomon let him live. Okay, even though he had tried to become king, he said, as long as you're not a threat, and as long as you obey, as long as you behave yourself, everything will be fine. But then Adonijah does a power play. Adonijah does a power play here when he tries to go and marry Abishag, okay, who was the girl who had been David's right-hand girl, trying to keep him warm as he was older. So as a result, Solomon had him killed after this power play. Okay, he had given him a chance, but he proved himself not trustworthy. And then verse 27, Solomon removed Abiathar from the priesthood of the Lord, fulfilling the word that the Lord had spoken at Shiloh about the house of Eli. So he had removed Abiathar from the priesthood, okay, which did two things. Number one, Abiathar had supported Adonijah, had helped Adonijah when Adonijah tried to become king. But then it also fulfilled a prophecy that Eli's house will no longer have any old men serving. And so here, Adonijah, before he got old, was kicked out of the priesthood, or Abiathar. And then verse 29, two verses later, King Solomon was told that Joab had fled to the tent of the Lord and beside the altar. And Solomon ordered Benaiah, son of Jehoiada, go strike him down. Okay? So he had Joab killed. Joab had stood up and supported Adonijah. But he had also created problems for David, and David was afraid of Joab. And this is when Joab had killed Abner, the son of Ner, Saul's commander, and etc. And this is one of the things that David had told Solomon to take care of for him, and he did. He had Joab killed. And then verse 46, the other one that David told him to take care of was Shimei. And it says, the king gave orders to Benaiah, son of Jehoiada, and he went out and struck Shimei down and killed him. The kingdom was now firmly established in Solomon's hands. Now, Solomon had given ample opportunity to Shimei. He said, as long as you stay in Jerusalem, everything's fine. Don't you ever leave Jerusalem. If you do, the day you do is the day you bring death upon yourself. Well, he did. He left and brought death upon himself. Okay, and that's what you see here. And it says then that the kingdom was firmly established in Solomon's hands here. Okay? All right. One more thing about his reign is where did he reign and how long? 1 Kings chapter 11, verse 42. Solomon reigned in Jerusalem over all of Israel for 40 years. Okay, so here we see another 40. David was 40 years. Saul was 42. There's that biblical number of 40, right? Now, we don't know how old Solomon was when he took over. The thought is somewhere around 20, okay, that he was younger than the others. But he had a long kingship as well. So here you see 122 years of the United Kingdom from when Saul became king to when Solomon died. All right? All right, highlights and lowlights of Solomon. What spiritual gift did God give to Solomon? Now, this is the popular Sunday school lesson, so you probably know the story in 1 Kings chapter 3. If you didn't read it again, because it's always interesting to read things from an adult perspective. Verse 9, Solomon prays to God and says, "Give your servant a discerning heart to govern your people and to distinguish between right and wrong. For who's able to govern this great people of yours?" The Lord was pleased that Solomon had asked for this. So God said to him, "Since you've asked for this and not for long life or wealth for yourself, nor have asked for the death of your enemies, but for discernment in administering justice, I'll do what you've asked. I'll give you a wise and discerning heart so that there will never have been anyone like you, nor there will there ever be. Moreover, I'll give you what you have not asked for, both riches and honor, so that in your lifetime you'll have no equal among kings. And if you walk in my ways and obey my statutes and commands as David your father did, I will give you a long, long life." Okay? So God gave him the gift of wisdom that Solomon had asked for, but he also gave him riches and honor and the ability to have a long, long life. Well, we see that he lasted, 60 years, I guess, you know, from 40 years as king, and if he started around 20, okay, so it's not like he was, well, he wasn't as old as his father David or his predecessor Saul, so something may have happened there. We'll get that as we get in there. So we see some examples of wisdom, okay, the Sunday school lesson that you remember, we see in verse 25 the result of it. Solomon gave an order, "Cut the living child in two and give half to one and half to the other." The woman whose son was alive was filled with compassion for her son and said to the king, "Please, my lord, give her the living baby. Don't kill him." But the other said, "Neither I nor you shall have him. Cut him in two." Then the king gave this ruling, "Give the living baby to the first woman. Don't kill him. She's the mother." Okay? So you see his wisdom coming out in this argument over whose baby this kid belonged to. Then chapter 4, verse 29 through 34. Tells us quite a bit. God gave Solomon wisdom and very great insight and a breadth of understanding as measureless as sand on the seashore. Solomon's wisdom was greater than the wisdom of all the men of the East and greater than all the wisdom of Egypt. He was wiser than any other man, including Ethan the Ezrahite, wiser than Hermon, Chalcol, Darda, the sons of Machol, and his fame spread to all the surrounding nations. He spoke 3,000 proverbs, and his songs numbered 1,005. He described plant life from the cedar of Lebanon to the hyssop that grows out of the walls. He also taught about animals and birds and reptiles and fish. Men of all nations came to listen to Solomon's wisdom, sent by all the kings of the world who had heard of his wisdom. So you see, his wisdom became renowned the world over. He was the wisest man in the world. And then you've got the story of the Queen of Sheba who comes to check up on him. And what does she think about his wisdom after she sees it? Chapter 10, verses 6 and 7. She said to the king, "The report I heard in my own country about your achievements and your wisdom is true. But I didn't believe these things until I came and I saw with my own eyes. Indeed, not even half was told me. In wisdom and wealth, you have far exceeded the report I heard." Okay? So his wisdom impressed the Queen of Sheba. Now, there's another thing that he's known for. We see in 1 Kings chapter 6. This is something that his father really wanted to do but couldn't. In chapter 6, verse 1, "In the 480th year after the Israelites had come out of Egypt, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel, in the month of Ziv, the second month, Solomon began to build the temple of the Lord. And then verse 38, the last verse of that chapter, says that in the 11th year of the month of Bull, the 8th month, the temple was finished in all of its details according to its specifications. He had spent 7 years building it. So he built the temple. The temple that David wanted to build, and God said, no, you're not going to build it. Your son, the man of peace, is going to build this. That's what Solomon means. That's what his name means, is peace. Okay? The man of peace. And so he built the temple. It took him 7 years. What's interesting, we see in the very next verse, is that it took Solomon 13 years, however, to complete the construction of his palace. So he built this palace, took almost twice as long to build it as he took to build the temple. Okay? So you know that it was magnificent. How did he fund all of this construction and expansion? And, because you take a look, you've got a map here that shows you what the kingdom was like, how extensive the United Kingdom of Israel was under these kings. And under Solomon is where you see the greatest breadth. Okay, if you look at page, that's not numbered, but page 7 in your handout, you see that the light part on the inside that covers Judah and Israel, that's where Saul, okay, that was Israel under Saul. And then you see the shaded area, and that is the area that David brought under his control, okay, with the peace that he brought and the control he brought way up past Damascus. And then you see the dashed lines going on even further, and that's the land that Solomon brought to Israel. And so he had the greatest physical territory here. So how could he afford all this? And how could he afford this great palace and temple and other construction projects he did? He built big walls around cities and all of that. 1 Kings chapter 4, verse 21 and verse 24. And Solomon ruled over all the kingdoms of the river, from the river, okay, that's the Euphrates River, to the land of the Philistines as far as the border of Egypt. So that's why you see that dashed line there. So all the way from the Euphrates River all the way up to the border with Egypt. These countries brought tribute and were Solomon's subjects all his life. And we've talked about tribute before. Tribute was when one nation was subject to another nation. The subject nation had to annually bring great sums of money called tribute to keep that other nation from destroying them. Okay, it's kind of, you might call it protection money or blood money or whatever, but that's what would happen. And so he received a lot of money of tribute from all these other nations. And then verse 24, for he ruled over all the kingdoms west of the river from Tiphsah to Gaza and had peace on all sides. So he also had peace. So he didn't have great expenses with the military. Okay, he had power and peace. And so he had all this tribute that came in. How much? Turn back a little further to chapter 10, verse 14, says that the weight of the gold that Solomon received yearly, whether from tribute and his business enterprises and all that, was 666 talents. Well, that might sound like a lot if you knew what a talent was. Well, this works out to 25 tons. 25 tons of gold he received every year. What a great wealth. He had tremendous wealth. Okay? Like God had said, not only will I give you wisdom, but I will give you riches and honor beyond anyone else in the world. Okay? And Solomon was greatly blessed. Verse 22 of that same chapter. The king had a fleet of trading ships at sea, along with ships of Hiram. Once every 3 years it returned, carrying gold, silver, and ivory, and apes, and baboons. Okay? Just enjoyable stuff, okay? So it was a time of luxury, time of luxury. So it sounds then that this was really Israel's golden era. Not the time of David, but Solomon's. I mean, look at the peace and the prosperity and the wealth and gosh, you've got luxury items and, you know, the baboons and stuff that, you know, why would they bring those in? Just for fun, right? So it was a great time. But it wasn't. There was a big problem. And that problem we see in chapter 11. King Solomon, however, loved many foreign women. Besides Pharaoh's daughter, there were Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonians, and Hittites. They were from nations about which the Lord had told the Israelites that you must not intermarry with them because they will surely turn your hearts after their gods. Nevertheless, Solomon held fast to them in love. He had 700 wives of royal birth and 300 concubines, and his wives led him astray. As Solomon grew old, his wives turned his heart after other gods, and his heart was not fully devoted to Yahweh his God, as the heart of David his father had been. He followed Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and Molech, the detestable god of the Ammonites. So Solomon did evil in the eyes of the Lord. He did not follow Yahweh completely as his father David had done. What a horrible thing. Everything is so great, and now he destroys it. We're going to see as we talk about other kings in the future, the mark of a good king dealt with their relationship with God, dealt with their faithfulness to God. And Solomon lost that. He was faithful for so much of his life and so much of his reign, but as he got older, he turned away from God. He worshiped other gods. He built temples for these gods and went and with his wives and worshiped in them. Even Molech and all these horrible gods that we've talked about, how these gods were despicable to God, okay, and the practices of the Canaanites were despised by God. And so he turned from God. He also created some other problems for Israel, mainly because of his expensive taste. Chapter 4, verse 7 of 1 Kings. Solomon also had 12 district governors over all of Israel who supplied provisions for the king and the royal household. Each one had to provide supplies for 1 month in the year. So every month, a different tribal group, actually it wasn't just tribes, it was, he divided up Israel into districts that weren't just according to the tribes, and each 12th part of Israel had a month that they had to provide for all the stuff that was needed by Solomon and his household and his government and all the provisions, and you can look at that, it's huge. If you look at it in, starting in verse 20 through verse 28 of chapter 4, okay? So how did they do that? Heavy taxation. They had to tax the people. There was heavy taxation here. And then chapter 5, verse 13. King Solomon conscripted laborers from all of Israel, 30,000 men. He sent them off to Lebanon in shifts of 10,000 a month so that they spent 1 month in Lebanon and 2 months at home. Adoniram was in charge of the forced labor. So he even turned his own people into slaves. He forced them into labor, forced them to do his work. Conscripted them, drafted them into service, not military service, but working service to go cut down timbers for all his building projects up in Lebanon. Okay, cut down timbers in Lebanon to bring down. So heavy taxation and forced labor were also part of the mark of Solomon's reign. So as we go to our picture again then, and we look at the crown on the far right, this third crown is to designate the reign of Solomon. And you see that there's a yoke attached to this crown, and that reminds us that Solomon's policies led to heavy taxation and forced labor. Okay? So that was not the golden era like the time of David was. The note at the bottom of page 5 is Solomon was a city boy who never had any country. Okay. All right, let's do a real quick review of the picture. Okay, we start out by seeing the banner that entwines itself around and through the crowns, and that reminds us that the 12 tribes were united under kings here, under these three kings. The inscriptions on the banner, each of those refer to one of the tribes. Those are the symbols of the tribes. Pillars rising from the throne base up to the heavens reminds us that the kings were selected by God. They weren't selected by people. They weren't selected by succession. They were selected by God. Okay. The crown on the far left refers to the reign of Saul, and you notice that the crown is dark, and that reminds us that Saul's kingship met violent opposition, and it wasn't a kingship after God's heart either. It had a lot of problems. The crown in the center is the reign of David. Star of David, the mace, and the light over the crown reminds us that David's era was a golden age for Israel. Okay? Golden age. Three diamonds and one dark pearl on the crown are the four major events in David's reign. The first diamond is Jerusalem being made the capital city, the national capital, the political capital of Israel. The second diamond reminding us that David took care of the Philistine menace that we talked about in our last study. and other political threats were removed. The third diamond is reminds us that David made Jerusalem the religious capital, the religious center of the nation. And then the dark pearl reminds us of the troubles that David brought in by his sin with Bathsheba. The disunity in the kingdom resulted from David's sin with Bathsheba. And then the crown on the far right is the reign of Solomon, okay, the third king of the United Kingdom. You see a yoke attached to that third crown, and that reminds us that Solomon's policies led to heavy taxation and forced labor and led to some problems, and we'll see what happens as a result of that in 2 weeks. Okay, in 2 weeks we'll pick up the continuation of the story of the kingdoms and the kings, but next week we're going to talk about the role of the prophet, because it's now at this time that we will start seeing prophets come into the picture and understand what they're about. Okay? Let's close with prayer. God, our Father, boy, you've given us lots of interesting stories. But those interesting stories are there to help us learn more about you and more about our life with you and our relationship with you and what you expect of us and how we're to live as your people. And we see that Saul had so much going for him, but he turned from you early on and lost all the potential that he had. David, as great as he was a man after your heart. You loved him. You blessed him. He followed you, but yet he was sinful as well as us. He had the great sin that created all sorts of problems for us, just as we have great sins that create all sorts of problems for us. And then we looked at the stories of Solomon. And he started out great, in a great relationship with you, but then he turned from you. And we see that that could happen to us as well, that we're called to continue to remain faithful to you, to persevere in our faith as Paul calls us to do, as you call us to do. Help us to take the stories that we have of these three kings and use them as examples to guide us in our life with you, in our life as your people. We pray in the name of your Son, who showed us how it can be done. In Christ's name, amen.